Tonight I'd like to pick up in the Old Testament where we had left off. We were going to begin with the book of Haggai. If you can't find it, just go back to the last book in the Old Testament, which is Malachi. Back up two books because they've got Malachi, Zechariah, and then Haggai. Let me just give you some brief background of exactly where Haggai is coming from and who he was and what was his mission and what God used him for. First of all, you got to go way back to the Babylonian captivity. Go back to the first deportation to Jews is around 605 B.C. I think Daniel and his companions, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they were the ones who were part of the first deportation. I think the second deportation was around 597, 598 B.C. And then finally, the temple, Solomon's temple, was destroyed in 586 B.C. Now, I'm not going to try to bore you with a lot of dates, but just keep something in mind here. Okay, temple was completely destroyed because of the people's sins and their waywardness, their rebellion, and everything else. And then they were led off into Babylon to remain there until the 70 years was complete as far as their punishment was concerned. Jeremiah predicted that they would be there for 70 years, okay? If you back up to the first deportation and you add up the number of years, you find out it's just about exactly 70 years when Cyrus the Great, in 536 B.C., told the Jews that they could go back to their homeland. And if you read in the book of Ezra, you find that 50,000 Jews decided that they were going to go back to their whole homeland and rebuild the temple and rebuild their houses and get their lives back together. Okay, so around 536 B.C., under the decree of Cyrus, which actually he was predicted, but Cyrus, long before he was even born, God predicted through his prophets that he would raise up a man by the name of Cyrus who he would use as an instrument who would let his people go back from captivity. So they got back to Jerusalem around 536, around 535 B.C. When they got there, one of the first things that they did was that they started to rebuild the temple, Solomon's temple. And after 2 years' time, they were able to lay down the foundation. But what happened was that they were constantly harassed by the Samaritans and some of the other people that were there who had basically occupied the land, you know, the 70 years that the Jews were gone. And the Samaritans, remember, they were half-breeds. They were half-Jew and then half, well, Canaanites. What happened to was way back in the Assyrian deportation, a lot of the poorest of the poor people were allowed to stay in the land, and then they intermarried with all the pagans. So they were half-Jew and half-Gentile. And as far as the Jews are concerned, they were dogs. But the Samaritans wanted a hand in building this temple, rebuilding the temple. And what happened was that the Jews said, no, you're going to have no part of it. What took place after that was that there was a constant conflict or friction between the Samaritans and the Jews, and the reconstruction of the temple completely went to the wayside. They were up against harassment from their neighbors, from political harassment, from military harassment, and so they just finally decided to heck with it. They let the temple foundation just sit there. And it wasn't until about 15 or 16 years later. Here it is, the temple site is just the foundation there. It's all overgrown with weeds and nettles and thorns and everything else. And the people have completely neglected it. They just figured, well, we couldn't get it rebuilt, so why bother? It must not be God's timing. It must not be God's will. Now, keep a few things in mind, okay? Haggai is going to be used by God to stir up the people once again to get over there to rebuild this temple. Okay? What is the temple of God today? The temple of God is the church. All right? And to me, the message is very, very, I think, important for us today to recognize that, hey, there's still a temple to be built. Peter says that we are all, you know, living stones being built up in the temple of God as Christ's church. So I really feel like when we read this, we got to keep in mind that it really has a profound message for us today because, hey, God wants us to invest time, money, energy, and effort into building his church up. If we neglect to do that, as far as God is concerned, our priorities are way out of whack and we're not in a position where he can bless us or that he will bless us. And that's what Haggai told his people way back then. Now keep a few other things in mind, okay? Solomon's Temple, which was, I guess, erected around 960, 950 BC. How long did it take to build Solomon's Temple? It took 7 years, okay, to build the temple. But actually, David, long before the construction of the temple began, David started collecting all of, a great deal of the materials, a great deal of the timber and the stone, everything that was going to go into it. He was collecting it. But if you read in the Chronicles, I think Second Chronicles, around the 4th, 5th, 6th chapter, what's described there, I think it's pretty amazing, because Solomon had something like 70,000 transporters. In other words, people that would transport stones and timber and fabric and gold and silver and stone. 70,000. In the mountains, he had 80,000 quarers or stone cutters. These stones were cut at the stone site, each one perfectly cut, because when they brought the stones into Jerusalem to be fitted in place for the temple, none of the stones were needed to be cut or hammered into place, because everyone fit just right. To me, that's kind of significant, okay? There was no axe, no saw, no hammer used on these stones at the temple site. Everything was quarried, everything was cut, everything was measured in the quarry. Well, what does that tell you in a spiritual sense? If we are the stones, and we're being built up in the temple of God,
Well,
what's kind of significant to me is that the quarry almost seems like symbolically represents the world. We are down here in the world, and we are the living stones that are being fashioned and shaped and molded, okay, here. But once we pass from this life into the next life, there is not going to be any more fashioning and shaping and molding. We are going to be fitted in to this temple of God. Now, this is all figurative speaking. Okay, but this is what I think was symbolizing. So you got 80,000 guys out there in the quarries cutting these stones, 70,000 transporters, and you had something like 3,600 supervisors, and you had the king Hiram from Tyre. He was contributing all kinds of labor, very skilled labor. He was contributing timber, cedar, all of these different things. And then when they went into building this temple, it took them 7 years to complete it. Now, it wasn't a real big structure. It was only like 60 cubits by 90 cubits. I mean, it wasn't very big in comparison to our modern-day buildings. But it was so magnificent that it became one of the seven wonders of the world. When Nebuchadnezzar destroyed this temple, he didn't leave one stone standing upon another. It was completely demolished. It was set on fire. And so these people had to rebuild it. And they gave up. They just left the foundation there after a great deal of frustration. Now they're going to rebuild it. And once they get it rebuilt, it takes them. We're not given exact dates here, but it took them about 5 years. And when it was completed, some of the old men who had remembered the temple the way it was when they were very young, they began to weep. All the young people who built the temple, this second temple, it was referred to as Zerubbabel's temple. You know, they were all rejoicing and they were all happy and they were all glad. And the old men who remembered the old glorious temple started crying, because there was almost like no comparison. And the prophet decided to tell them, hey, you know, listen, you know, some of you people who remember the way it used to be, he says, don't weep about that, because God's going to take this temple and he's going to, you know, bless this temple or magnify this temple even greater than Solomon's temple. And I'll explain that later. But I just wanted to give you basically a background of what this book is all about. It's about a prophet God is using to try to stir up a bunch of people who became discouraged, and they figure, what's the point in trying to build this temple under such difficult circumstances. Now, that's the same message to us today. I'm going to tell you right now, I have to deal with this constantly, this discouragement, feeling like, hey, what's the point in spending so much time, money, energy, and effort into a Bible study that doesn't seem to really be going anywhere? There doesn't seem to be a great deal of interest. I don't seem to be accomplishing a whole lot. And after 25 years, you think you'd have something to show for it. Well, you know, that's my flesh. That's, you know, my natural reaction to what I don't see a great deal happening. But I have to say to myself, well,
I've got to keep at it. I don't feel like I'm accomplishing a great deal, but that's not for me to decide in the end. It's up to God. My responsibility is to do whatever job he's given me to do. And I think that that's each and every one of our responsibilities. In building up God's church, we have an obligation, a responsibility. Remember that God's given each and every one of us specific gifts, whether we believe it or not. We do all have certain talents, certain gifts, certain abilities, certain resources that God expects us to use for the building up of his church. And if we neglect to do that, we're not only sinning, but we put ourselves in a position where we are no longer going to be blessed by God in other areas of our life. Okay, well, just with that in mind, let's pick up with verse 1 in the book of Haggai. Keep in mind that they started the temple, and then it's now laid desolate for like 15 years. They've done nothing with it. They became discouraged and disheartened in their attempts to rebuild it, and they figure, what's the point? Look at what he says in this verse 1. In the second year of Darius the king, on the first day of the sixth month, the word of the Lord came by the prophet Haggai to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest. Okay, now Darius the king, he was the king of Persia. Remember, Israel didn't have a king now, but they did have a governor, and the governor was named Zerubbabel. He was the one that came back with Ezra, with some 50,000 people after they came back, after Cyrus let the people come back to their homeland. Zerubbabel, if you study his genealogy, he was from the lineage of David. Matter of fact, he's mentioned in, Matthew chapter 1 and Luke chapter 3, as far as the genealogy is concerned, that he was the descendant of David, and so he was part of the royal line, and so he didn't act as king, but he acted as governor. Okay, he came back with the deportees, and he was put in charge. And, of course, it was his responsibility, or him and the high priest, Joshua, the high priest at the time, to stir up the people to build the temple. And, like I said, they started out real good and then became discouraged. How many people do that in God's work? Happens all the time. So it's almost like God has to stir people up again, and he goes to the leaders, because it's so important that the leadership. You've got Zerubbabel and you've got the high priest. In other words, you've got the political leaders and you've got your religious leaders. Even today, these two groups of people are so instrumental as far as the moral condition, the spiritual condition of a nation. And all we have to do is look at the type of leadership that we have today, morally and spiritually, and we can see why we've gone from what I consider to be a Christian nation, a godly nation, a Christ-like nation, to a pagan, hedonistic nation. And within 30, 40, 50 years, I mean, there's no comparison to what we once were as a nation to where we are at today. And I think that it has a lot to say as far as the leaders are concerned. And then he says here in that verse 2, he says, "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, this people says, the time has not come, even the time of the house of the Lord, to be rebuilt." Now, it's just interesting. Very often God refers to his people as my people. Here he says this people. I think, I don't want to split hairs and sling hash over it, but it's almost kind of like an indication or a suggestion, okay, that these people aren't really God's people. In other words, they claim to be God's people, but their priorities are such that God says, hey, they're not my people. He refers to them as these people. These people run to their own houses to take care, to panel their houses with wood and with cedar, and to do everything they can as far as they're improving their homes, their materialistic things that they put so much emphasis on, and they completely neglect the things of God. I mean, I see this today, and it's so prevalent that there's so many people who say they love God, know God, pray to God, or whatever, but do they go to church regularly? A lot of them don't even go twice a year, but, let alone once a week. But they say they have this, I guess, this false sense of security that, well, I'm all right with God. But here again is priorities. It always amazes me when people will come up with a million lame excuses why they can't go to church on Sunday, but if they get an opportunity to go to Lake Tahoe, to throw money down a toilet in those slot machines, I mean, there isn't a blizzard known to man that will stop them. Right? I mean, is it priorities or not? This is where the rubber meets the road. If God is really important to us, it will be reflected in our priorities. Is that perfect logical sense? I mean, to me it is. I mean, to me, it's a contradiction of terms for people to say, well, I love God, but I don't go to church. It just doesn't make sense. I mean, because your priorities aren't there. Now, I've told people, I mean, people have said to me many times over the years, well, I don't have to go to church to be saved. And I agree with that 100%. You do not have to go to church to be saved. But I also feel this very strongly. If you are saved, you'll go to church. Why? Because God will become your priority in your life. And it will be reflected by putting Him first in the things that you do. So when God is referring to these people as these people or this people, I think there's something that's inferred there. As far as these people say that they love me, they know me, they believe in me, they're committed to me, but they're not really my people because they're completely ignoring me. And remember what Jesus said in Matthew on Judgment Day. He's going to say there's going to be many, many people say to Him in that day, hey, Lord, didn't we do miracles in Your name and cast out demons in Your name and do this in Your name and that in Your name? And He's going to say, depart from me, you practitioners of iniquity, I never knew you. So it's very, very, very possible to give God all kinds of lip service, have this false sense of security that we're going to heaven, and if our priorities aren't right, we're just kidding ourselves. So He says, we'll pick up with verse 2 again. It says, thus saith the Lord of hosts, this people says, the time has not come, even the time for the house of the Lord to be rebuilt. Then the word of the Lord came by Haggai the prophet, saying, is it time for you yourselves to dwell in your paneled houses while this house lies desolate? Now therefore, thus saith the Lord, consider your ways. You have sown much, but harvest little. You eat, but there is not enough to be satisfied. You drink, but there is not enough to become drunk. You put on clothing, but no one is warm enough. And he who earns wages to put in a purse with holes. He says in verse 7, thus saith the Lord, consider your ways. Twice He says, consider your ways. And I guess what you could do is you could look at the situation as far as this nation is concerned. Okay, this nation has really ignored God, neglected God. We have completely put our focus of attention on the things of this world, especially things like materialism and, entertainment and pleasure, these type of things. But just take, for example, material things and money. Well, this is where, basically, as a nation, where our priorities are. You see what I'm saying? It's like, well, where are we at? When we say, in God we trust on all our dollar bills, but that's the biggest crock of baloney I've ever seen. It's the money that we put so much emphasis on, but yet look at where we are at as a nation. We are becoming a nation of bankrupt people, not just morally, but also economically. Our economy is doing real well right now. But the truth of the matter is that people are going further and further in debt. More and more people are filing for bankruptcy every single week. I mean, I'm just saying that if we really look at what's happening to us, is that our consumer debt we are drowning in. Our national debt we are drowning in. And I believe that this is, to me, one more judgment of where our priorities are at. Because I do believe that if we really put God first in our lives, as a nation, as a whole, I don't believe that we would be seeing the individual bankruptcy, monetarily speaking, that we're seeing in this country. I just bring this to your attention and try to apply it to what Haggai was trying to tell his people, because God was basically saying, hey, listen, if you get your priorities right, I will bless you materialistically. Now, Jesus said the same thing how?
Seek first the kingdom of heaven, and all things will be added to you.
Jesus basically said, seek first the kingdom of heaven and God's righteousness, and all these other things will be added unto you. Okay, now that's a promise of His. Now that's not to say that, I don't like to get into this health, wealth, and prosperity baloney, but I do believe that God does set certain things in motion, just like He does with the physical laws, natural laws of nature. He has these physical, spiritual laws too. He says the spiritual laws are, hey, give and it will be given unto you. We have to go down in order to come up. We have to die in order to live. I mean, all of these are just different paradoxes, but I think that there are also spiritual laws or dynamics that God has incorporated into His church and His in the spiritual realm. that he just says, okay, if you do certain things, this will be the end result. And the end result of putting God first in our lives is blessings, including materialistic blessings. Now, that's not, I'm not preaching health, wealth, and prosperity here by any means. I'm just simply saying that as a whole, if we put God first, God's going to take care of our physical needs as well. Anyway, I wanted to associate this with, if you read that verse 5, it says, "Now therefore, thus saith the Lord, consider your ways." And he also says in verse 7, "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways." A couple things to keep in mind. He must say the Lord of hosts 3, 4, 5 different times. That's what he's referring to God as, the Lord of hosts. What does that mean? What is that title?
Everything.
Yeah.
Lord over angels, Lord over men,
Lord over everyone. He's the Lord of armies, the Lord of lords, the King of kings, the God of gods. In other words, he's the ultimate supreme authority. Nobody's over. He's over everyone and everything. And he sees everyone and everything. And he knows everyone and everything. Okay? Whether they be devils, whether they be angels, whether they be men, it doesn't matter. You know, Jesus himself said that his Father, not even a sparrow falls from heaven without his Father's notice. So in other words, this is the God of the universe saying, consider your ways. Now, he says that twice. Consider your ways. Now, if we could look at us as a nation, if we would just stop and consider our ways, when we kicked them out of our schools in 1963, our school system has taken a nosedive, and we have been in a graveyard spin ever since, and yet everybody's trying to grab a hold of the steering wheel saying, well, you know, we got to do something, rather than saying, hey, let's go back and consider our ways. Where did we go wrong? We went wrong when we kicked God out of our schools, right? But we don't consider our ways, do we? This is one small example of what I'm referring to as far as if we just would stop and think intelligently, logically, use some common sense, but we don't. Instead, we just feel like, well, we got a problem. We just got to keep throwing more and more money at it. Okay? So it says, he says in verse 7, "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways, go up to the mountains, bring wood and rebuild the temple that I may be pleased with it and be glorified, says the Lord." I back up here and it says in that verse 4, it says, "It is time for you to dwell in your paneled houses while this house lies desolate." They had, I guess, some pretty nice houses. They had stone and timber houses, but they also took cedar paneling and paneled it inside. I mean, they made their houses look really, really nice. And it is possible, if you read back in the book of Ezra, it says that Ezra and Joshua at the time that they came back from their Babylonian captivity, that they got together a lot of the materials that were needed to build the temple. And one of the things that they had an abundance of was cedar wood that they cut down from the mountains. And so they had all the cedar wood laying there ready to be used for the temple site. Now, it doesn't tell us that these people used that wood, but I would be willing to venture to guess that if the people said, hey, it's not time to do this. It's not time to build the temple because nothing's going in our favor. So why let the wood rot? Why let the wood go to waste? We might as well use the wood ourselves in our own house. Now, that's speculative on my part, okay? But I would say that they would probably justify that in order to use these resources, these materials that were really supposed to be for God. This happens a lot in our everyday walk in terms of giving our tithe money, right? Mm-hmm. Giving money to God, to our churches, or to, you know, for God's work of the building up of this kingdom. We can always justify and rationalize and say, hey, well, you know, it's really not time to use this for this purpose now. I need it for this particular purpose, and so on and so forth. Well, if you read in the book of Malachi, which is after this, which is two books after this, God asked the people, hey, will a man rob God? Are you going to rob me? In other words, hey man, bring the full tithe into the storehouse and see if I won't shower down such blessings that you won't be able to contain it all. So in other words, it's like we're put to the test. We really need to quit trying to rationalize and justify and say, well, I really need to use my tithe money for other purposes. You know, I need a cruise, I need a vacation. We can always easily, I think, justify and rationalize it, right?
Yeah,
well, absolutely. It's so easy to do. So, I mean, I'm just simply saying it's very possible that these people said, well, we might as well use the wood instead of let it go to waste. Verse 8 says, "Go up to the mountains, bring wood, and rebuild the temple, that I may be pleased with it and be glorified, says the Lord." And now he gives them a direct command of what to do. And then he says in verse 9, "You look for much, but behold, it comes too little. When you bring it home, I blow it away." I think of that a lot, too. I think, well, you know, where is it? It's gone, you know. with a little help of my wife, it's gone. It says, and blow it away. Why? Declares the Lord of hosts. Because of my house, which lies desolate, while each of you runs to his own house. That's kind of interesting. To me, it's like they leave God, they neglect God's house, they neglect God's work, and they run to their own house. In other words, they show a great deal of enthusiasm for what? Doing what they want to do, what's important to them. I've always said that. I've said it 1,000 times, and I'll go to my grave saying it. We can always find the time, the money, the energy, the resources to do what we really want to do. I really believe that. We can always find the time to do what we really want to do. If we don't want to do something, we can always come up with 100,000 different lame excuses why we can't do it. Why we can't go to church. Okay, why we can't go to Bible study. Why we can't go to prayer meeting. Why we can't get involved in doing God's work. Because we're just too preoccupied. But I'm telling you, priorities are everything. I mean, I work every single Sunday. But every single Sunday I go to church. Now, I don't say that to boast. I'm just simply saying if I can't get to church because of work, then I got to change my work schedule. It's all a matter of priorities. You can find time to do what you really want to do, or what's really important to you. Okay, so then he says, read verse 9 and 10 together. You look for much, but behold, it comes to little. When you bring it home, I blow it away. Why, declares the Lord of hosts? Because my house, which lies desolate, while each of you runs to his own house, therefore, because of you, the sky has withheld its dew, and the earth has withheld its produce. I called for a drought on the land, on the mountains, on the grain, on the new wine, on the oil, on what the ground produces, on men, on cattle, and on all the labors of your hands. Now, God is saying this. He's using nature to punish or to use as a judgment against men who have their priorities in the wrong place. I don't care whether it's droughts, whether it's forest fires, whether it's floods, whether it's earthquakes, whether it's hailstones. God is using nature to what? Try to get man's attention. Right? I mean, that's what he's doing here. He's saying, consider your ways, and he says, I've called for a drought. Then he says in verse 10, it says, therefore, because of you, look at this nation. Therefore, because of this nation, we are suffering all these things. Because of you, the sky has withheld its dew, and the earth has withheld its produce. He says, I called for a drought on the land, on the mountains, on the grain, and the new wine, the oil, and on all that the ground produces, on men, on cattle, on all the labor of your hands. Then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and the Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, with all the remnant of the people, obeyed the voice of the Lord their God and the words of Haggai the prophet, as the Lord God had sent them. And the people showed reverence for the Lord. Then Haggai, the messenger of the Lord, okay, now, this is kind of interesting to me. Haggai is one of the few prophets you will find in the Old Testament that really seen a change of heart in the people that he was preaching to. You notice that? I mean, look at poor Jeremiah, or Ezekiel, or Isaiah, or a number of the minor prophets, prophet after prophet after prophet, would be warning people of God's coming judgment if they didn't change their ways, and people would just ignore them, or they would mock them, they would ridicule them, they would stone them, they would kill them. Even Jesus himself said, hey, which prophet haven't you killed? You know, from Abel through the righteous Zechariah that he killed between the altar and the temple, remember? And so if you look at the number of prophets that had come up against a stone wall as far as people repenting and turning around, I think Haggai really shows he's right up there, as far as I'm concerned, with Jonah. He is a successful prophet as far as getting people to change their ways. But what's interesting to me is that what motivates these people? Haggai says, okay, here's your problem. You've neglected God. You've got to get your priorities right. And then God will bless you materialistically. So I think that was kind of a real motivating factor there, where they decided, hey, man, let's go ahead and get everything right with God, and then we'll finally, you know, start making some money, start making, be able to make ends meet or whatever. Whatever the reason was, it seems like this was a real motivating factor. Okay, for them to listen to Haggai. And so it says in verse 13, then Haggai, the messenger of the Lord, spoke by the commission of the Lord to the people, saying, I am with you, declares the Lord. And that's, I think, we got to keep in mind that even though things may not materialize the way we really would like them to. We don't see the fruit or of the labor that we put into something. You know, the time, the money, the energy, the effort that we may expend for trying to do God's will. We may not see a great deal of results, but the fact is, the Lord says, I'm with you. He says, he's just simply saying, I'm with you, declares the Lord. Isn't that what Jesus said? He said, lo, I'm with you even till the end of the world. Okay, we have to take that on faith. We have to take that, meaning that he's going to be with us in spite of our circumstances. Discouragement, frustration, disappointments, or setbacks and disillusionments, they're bound to come. But God says, I'm going to be with you. What our responsibility is to do what? To just simply obey and to work. To do what we can, while we can. Okay? Because night is coming, as Jesus said, when no man's going to be able to work. So he says, verse 14, so the Lord stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, the governor of Judah, and the spirit of Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and the spirit of the remnant of the people, and they came and worked on the house of the Lord of hosts, their God. Okay, so once the people decided to, you know, obey God, God stirred up their spirit, and then they worked as a team, worked as one, and they began to accomplish what God intended them to do. So he says in that verse 15, on the 24th day of the sixth month in the second year of Darius the king, that's when they began to work. So if you go up and you check it with the first verse, it says in the second year of Darius the king, the first day of the sixth month. This one on the verse 15 says on the 24th day of the sixth month. So in other words, it took them a little over 3 weeks before they really got going, constructing on a temple one. And I don't think it was through procrastination. I just think that when Haggai gave the message, it took them a little more than 3 weeks before they started building the temple, simply because I think obviously they had to regroup. They had to get their resources. They had to get the timber. They had to get the materials. They had to get the plans. They had to get everything organized, ready, prepared to do the work. Okay, they just didn't go out there half-cocked and with a hammer and saying, well, where do I start? They had to lay out all the plans and decide how they were going to do it. So I think the implication is that they weren't procrastinating. They weren't delaying. They were just simply doing things in a way that I think showed a little bit of a common sense and intelligence. Okay, now next Thursday, we finish up the book of Haggai, okay? And like I said, it's only two chapters, but keep in mind the background of this, because I think it's going to be really important when we go through the second chapter. Anybody have anything you want to add or share?